Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Bonnie Kay and Misty Hall from the Straight Wives Talk Show. This is a hard-hitting show that discusses the complexity of marriages between straight women to gay men. Each week, my co-hostess Misty Hall and I will discuss issues that affect over 4 million women in this country and millions more around the world who find themselves unknowingly married to a gay or bisexual man. And when I say a bisexual man, I mean a bisexual man who can't admit that he's gay. Right, Misty?
Yes.
Because, as you know, I believe in the myth of bisexuality, but a lot of men haven't come to terms with it yet, so I can certainly understand that. So how are you doing this week?
I'm doing well, Bonnie. Thanks for asking. I'm enjoying the weather, the beautiful blooms, the new season. Spring's always a favorite because it's like a rebirth and a renewal of everything, and it's just a wonderful time of the year for me. How about yourself?
I'm doing well. I'm trying to get over respiratory infection, but each day getting a little bit stronger, so that's good. At least I'm moving in a positive direction.
Right.
And I agree with you. I always feel that spring is a time for hope for women. And, you know, I think the winters just really depress women more and more than, you know, the spring does. So we're always glad to see the flowers blooming, you know, things to put you in positive motion. And, Misty, do you have any workshops that are coming up before we get started?
You caught me off guard. I do have one coming up in May. I think it's going to be a very good one. It's going to be a general one because every so often I try to offer a special one, and you know, one in a special topic. The one coming up in May is a little special in itself just because it's going to be general. And that one's going to be on May the 8th, and the title of it is Rebuilding. I think that's one of the most important things we have to learn how to do when we discover that our spouse or husband is gay or bisexual, is to rebuild. And in that hour and a half, and I usually say hour and a half, but they always go to 2-hour Saturday seminar, I'll be discussing some of the different things you can do to help your healing journey, some things that you can be in control of, because, you know, when our life spins out of control, when we figure out that our husband is gay, there's not much we feel like we can control. So once you start rebuilding your life, there are some things and some tips, different activities, and just some of the most simple things that you can do that can be so helpful to rebuild that solid foundation. Because it does strip you down. It strips you down to, it shakes your whole foundation. So I say you really have to rebuild. And that's what the seminar on May 8th is going to be about. It's just rebuilding. It's going to be a general topic seminar. And I always keep time at the end for questions and answers. And that's probably one of the most popular parts of the seminar. You know, you get access to me whenever you participate in one of the seminars, and everyone always has time to ask questions. And I treat that as such an important part of the seminar because, you know, when I was going through this, goodness, 15 years ago, I wish I would have had someone I could have called and asked questions to, you know, just for some hope, for some guidance, because I didn't know you back then. So that's what I try to do, is offer hope, offer guidance, and give examples of what's happened to me and how I move forward and move past certain things. So I think it'll be a really important Saturday seminar.
And how do people get in touch with you in case they are interested in joining that seminar?
They can email me. My email address is my name, and I will spell that out. It's Misty Lynn Hall, and that is spelled MistyLynnHall @AOL.com.
And in case they don't understand Southern English, I'll spell it out in Northern English. It's
okay. You be my. I'm the Southern. I'm the Southern, and you're the Yankee. You go ahead.
Yeah, pretty much. That. Misty Lynn Hall. MistyLynnHall @AOL.com. Misty has the cutest Southern accent, and I think sometimes people in the North are saying, "Wow," they're listening more to her accent than to what she's saying. So
probably that happens often. I'm used to it.
I know, I'm always mesmerized by your accent, Misty. I just
like
to sit and listen to you. But
you.
Even if you're talking about nothing, I enjoy it because I love listening to your accent.
Well, thank you, dear. Of course, I don't think I have one. Isn't that funny?
Yeah, that is funny.
Everyone else has one, not me.
Oh, okay. I see how it works.
Yeah, that's how it works.
You know, like I say, write to Misty, or if you have any questions, you can always contact me at bonk@aol.com. Also, if you're listening to the show, please feel free to access my website at www.gayhusbandswithans.com if you would like to have some of my newsletters or get on the monthly mailing list or join our online support group that happens twice a week. You know, if you need any kind of support whatsoever, that's what we're there for, to let you know that you're not alone. And tonight we have a really special guest who's going to be joining us shortly. And the guest that we're going to be having tonight is a doctor, Francine Barbetta, who's also a wonderful woman who I'm very friendly with. She lives in this part of the country with me here in Pennsylvania. And I've had the pleasure of meeting her in person. And she does family therapy, and she runs a support group for women who have gay husbands. And Francine has a book that's very interesting. It's called A Pebble in His Shoe, The Diary of a Straight Spouse. And she's going to be talking with us about this in a few minutes. So please stay tuned for Dr. Francine Barbetta, because I think that her words will really have a great impact on you, as well as her book. For people who are interested in buying it, you can purchase it through Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble, A Pebble in His Shoe, Dr. Francine Barbetta. So we'll be hearing a little bit about that soon. And also, Misty, I just want to announce, if we have listeners, that I'll be coming into New York for a get-together on May 22nd. If there are people in the New York City area or who have access to New York City, so please feel free to, you know, let me know. We would love to have you have lunch or dinner with us. And it's always wonderful when you find live support in other women, and we have some wonderful women coming, you know, who have been part of our support network. And these are women who are very uplifting and who can really make you feel better when you're finished meeting with them. I know that we had the chance to meet with some of them in Florida this past year, but we'll also have a chance to meet with some of them in New York also. So if you're interested, please make sure that, you know, you let me know, and we'll be happy to set that up for May 22nd. That's a Saturday in New York City. I really wish you could be there, Misty.
I do, too. I keep looking at my schedule, trying to tweak it, because I can tell you, I know it will be an unforgettable evening, because any time you come together with this type of women that have a shared background and they know what you've been through, it's an instant connection. I just cannot recommend it highly enough, and it will be unforgettable, and I know I'm going to be missing out. So I do am a little envious that I cannot come, but I just can't make it this time.
That's all right. We'll be thinking about you and talking about you, but only good things, so don't worry.
Of course. I'll be there in spirit. How's that? I'll certainly be there in spirit.
All right. That sounds good. And also I wanted to thank Wendy again for being here last week with us. Wendy, who gave us her recovery map, which I thought was such an important document. And if you missed our show last week, or if you missed my newsletter from this past month, and you would like a copy of Wendy's recovery map, which will really give you a great guidelines on what to expect to feel during those early months and the next year as you're going through this gay husband recovery, please let me know, and I'll be happy to send you a copy so that you can, you know, use it as a guide for yourself also. I think that Wendy's map really, you know, articulated so much for us as far as what we're feeling and all the different emotional impact that we have to go through, that when we're going through recovery, that a lot of women don't think about if they're not married to a gay man. I mean, there's so many extra issues that we have to go through. And I think one of the issues that we'll be talking about in the future also, Misty, is about, and I get so many letters about this, what if there's no proof, you know, and how to become your own detective. And women have such a difficult time if they don't have direct proof and they can't walk in on their husbands having sex with a man, you know, and I never quite understand why they need that proof. You know, to me the biggest proof of all is that you're unhappy in your marriage. 50% of straight people get divorced. You don't have to be gay to get have a gay husband to get a divorce, right?
Exactly, and that always bothers me when I think our group of women, or sometimes I call them our tribe of women, the straight wives, for some reason I think they have such a much greater difficulty in coming to the decision to have a divorce if they cannot find proof, when the proof is either in the mistreatment, the lies, all that stuff. And the one thing that we always fail to, I think, acknowledge, and I did myself with my own intuition. I knew something wasn't right, and I kept thinking that he was gay, but I kept feeling guilty for thinking that he was gay. And it just took me so long to act on it. It was just a very hard thing. And I do wish women would hear the message, you know, don't just keep waiting and putting it off.
Well, I think the important message is that 50% of the women who get divorced in this country don't have gay husbands. And they don't hesitate. They're not happy. They know the marriage is not fulfilling. They know that it's not giving them what they need to be satisfied as women, as mothers, as wives. And rather than prolong the agony, you know, they move out and they don't think twice about it. You know, they make a decision. But with our women, you know, we seem to feel that we need all this justification and we need proof. I mean, in other words, the only reason for divorce is gay, where that's not the case at all. Anytime you have a husband who is not, you know, meeting your needs or filling your needs on all these different levels, it's time to end it, you know. Mistakes happen. And, you know, like I say, that doesn't mean that you have to live with it forever.
Right, I agree. Because there is, I think what some of our women get so caught up in is that there's just, like, their life is over. I can tell you from my life began the moment I signed those papers. It truly did. I got to become who I was meant to be.
Exactly. Well, we have Francine who's going to be joining us in just a second, Misty. So let me just have her come into the show. Francine?
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, Bonnie. How are you?
Good. And Misty's with us also.
Terrific.
Misty's my co-therapist. And thanks for joining us on the Straight Wives Talk Show.
Okay.
And we just want to let women know, if you would like to call in, here's the phone number. If you have any questions you would like to ask Dr. Barbetta, it's area code 646-716-4893. I'll repeat that, area code 646-716-4893. So, Francine, thank you so much for joining us. We're so excited you could be here with us tonight.
Thank you for inviting me, Bonnie. I appreciate it.
Well, it's our pleasure. And, of course, primarily, we want to really talk about your book,
mm-hmm.
A Pebble in His Shoe. And for those people who haven't had the opportunity to read it, you know, this is really an essential book in your collection of reading, if you're a straight wife, on really excellent coping strategies and, you know, understanding this whole situation. So maybe you could take us through the book a little bit.
Sure, I would love to. I actually published the book in 2008, 3 years after my ex-husband committed suicide. And his suicide prompted me to realize just how important this message was that needed to get out there for wives to see the pain that and the struggle that their husbands are going through, and obviously for straight women to have another resource to turn to in their time of need, because God knows, you know, you've done a great job, Bonnie, getting
Thank
a lot
you.
Of books out there, but there's really not a lot of literature on this topic.
Mm-hmm.
So it felt important to me to get something out there.
So maybe you could tell us a little bit about your relationship, how it started, how you met, how it evolved.
Sure. My husband
and I... How it was pre-gay.
Excuse me?
How it was pre-gay.
Oh, pre-gay.
Before that word slipped into your marriage.
Yeah. Well, we met in 1977. We both had very similar backgrounds, Catholic, Italian. Didn't live very far from each other. Met at the Jersey Shore. Everything seemed picture perfect. On paper, we were just the perfect match. He always had a sadness in his eyes, though. And me, you know, being I was a social worker at the time, you know, eventually got more training, and but at the time I was a social worker, and I felt like it was my duty and my job on this earth to make this guy happy, because I saw a sadness in his eyes and I couldn't quite figure out what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And he seemed to really love me, and we had a lot of fun together. I can't say that we had a lot of passion together, but we had a lot of fun together.
About how old were you both at that point?
We were 17.
Oh, okay, you're both young.
Right. So he went off to college, and I went off to college, and we had a long-distance relationship for 4 years. And then when we came back, we got engaged. But one of the interesting things is that when I would visit him at college, I wanted to have sex with him, and he kept saying that we couldn't, that we shouldn't, that we needed to wait until we were engaged, which
mm-hmm.
ultimately is what ended up happening, you know, unfortunately. but, you know, it always struck me as kind of strange that here's this guy in college that didn't really want to have a sex life, and he had every excuse in the book. My father would be upset with him. What if I got pregnant? You know, what if...
And what year was that?
That was 1977.
So it wasn't that uncommon. You know, it's not like today where everybody's having sex. You know, back in 1977, there was still, you know, a large segment of the population that was buying into the whole theory of, yes, wait until you get married.
Mm-hmm. This is true, right.
So it didn't strike you as being that odd at that time, right?
Well, the strange thing is that I couldn't understand why I wanted to have sex and he didn't.
Oh, okay.
You know, that seemed a little weird to me. So, and I knew other people that were having sex, so it just seemed like we were dating so long, we were in love, we were committed to each other. Lo and behold, just fast forward 20 years, when he was in his coming out process, I found out that he was having sex with his college roommate.
Hmm.
So, of course, at the time, he was very homophobic. He
mm-hmm.
talked bad about gay people. He didn't want to be near gay people. He, you know, he was very straight-laced and conservative. And, you know, to me, I would never in a million years thought he was gay back then, even though he didn't want to have sex.
Mm-hmm. He didn't display any kind of effeminate behavior.
No.
Or what people talk about as the stereotypical gay characteristics.
No. I write about this in my book. You know, he was a chef by trade, but
mm-hmm.
he never really cooked at home. But I don't, you know, you can be a wonderful chef and not be gay. You can love to decorate and not be gay. You can hate sports and not be gay. Those things don't make someone gay. What makes someone gay is their desire to be with someone of the same sex.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, sometimes we get sucked into those stereotypes and they're not really true.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I never saw an indication that he would want to be with a man. So he seemed really in love with me. Everybody, even people now that knew us in college said that they felt that he was very in love with me.
Mm-hmm.
But what I have found a lot in my own private practice is that a lot of men in high school, even younger, start to think that they may be gay, and then they fall in love with a woman, and then they're able to have sex with her, and they think, oh, my God, I'm not gay, because all those feelings went away.
Mm-hmm.
I love a woman, and I can have sex. So, obviously, whatever I felt when I was 12 is gone. And then they latch on to that woman, and they fall. They're in love with her. Really, they. I do believe these men do fall in love. I don't think that's a farce. But they repress. Repression is a very powerful tool.
No, I agree with you. I always tell women that in almost all cases, I'm not going to say 100% of any case, but
mm-hmm.
in almost all cases, their husbands did love them when they married them,
mm-hmm.
and they were hoping against hope that, you know, the marriage would take away those nagging feelings and attractions that they still had.
Exactly.
And the fact that they were able to perform heterosexual sex, because not every gay man can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not even saying necessarily on a regular, you know, basis, but even at all.
Right.
The fact that they were able to perform heterosexual sex confused them more.
Right.
You know, hoping that this is really what their orientation was and those other feelings would go away. So
right.
I agree with you. You know, I certainly understand how this happens.
Yeah, I've seen some gay men as clients, and they said that there's no way in the world they could ever have sex with a woman. So
no, there isn't.
It is very confusing for a man who's struggling with his sexuality who can have straight sex.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and especially when he doesn't want to be gay.
Exactly. Just reinforces it even more.
Mm-hmm.
So
What age did you make a commitment to each other as far as getting married?
We were 21 when we got engaged, 22 when we married.
Mm-hmm.
We had, you know, a life where we worked paycheck to paycheck. We worked very hard for what we wanted and needed, and we had two children. We started a business, and at the time that we started a business, our children were already, you know, in preschool, grade school, and our business started to become extremely successful. We started traveling a lot. We moved to a bigger house, and once our life took that turn into being successful and he no longer needed to worry about money, that's when I say he started to explore the pebble in his shoe, because he had the time, he had the resources, and he certainly had the money to put himself out there to start opening himself up to his sexuality. And that's sort of how things started to evolve. He had just turned 40, or he was around 40, 38, 39, 40. They were his years of coming out.
No, you don't think that in between he was doing anything at all?
You know, Bonnie, I don't know that. I would, in retrospect, I
mm-hmm.
would say I'm certain he was,
right.
But I never had proof of it. He had a business trip to Paris, actually twice. He did come back from both those trips a little strange.
Mm-hmm.
So my guess was that he did something that he then felt guilty about.
Right.
I never had concrete evidence, but my intuition would be to say yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I see so many women in my practice that say, oh, my husband would never have a gay experience. They look at internet porn, they think it, they feel it, they have fantasies about it, but they would never actually do it.
Yeah.
And 9 times out of 10, those men are doing it. They're having sex somewhere.
Absolutely. I keep telling that to women.
Yeah.
Or I'm sure you have the women who say, there's no way my husband could be having sex. He doesn't have any time. I know where he is every minute.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear that a lot. And that's very sad.
You tell them it only takes 1 minute.
Yeah.
You can be in the restaurant with your husband. He goes into a men's room. He has a sexual encounter.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know a lot of men who do that.
Yeah, I wrote a story in my book. We were on vacation. I think we were in Puerto Rico at the time. And there was a very good-looking young guy. And he went into the we were at the pool. Frank and I were at the pool. The guy went into the, I guess it was into the restaurant area. And Frank was missing. And he was gone for like 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
He said he went to the bathroom. And, you know, I always have suspicion about that time. So, this, you know, what happens is that when you get, when you get out of a situation with a gay man, then you start reflecting back and you start
thinking about all the times when they were missing.
Right. You put the pieces of the puzzle together.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually, Frank started drinking pretty heavily when he did start the coming out process. It started because he met a man in a store, and he became very infatuated with this guy. And we had a successful business. We had a man who was running our business as a manager, and Frank wanted to hire this guy that he met in a store, a total stranger, for our business, which seemed just totally ridiculous to me. So I started to explore this man that he met. And I came home and I said, Frank, your friend is gay. And he said, oh, that's crazy. What are you talking about? Well, this went on for a year that he wanted to go to the gym with him. He wanted to go out to dinner with him. I could see that he was falling in love with this man.
Mm-hmm. Now, was this your first suspicion that something was truly going on?
My first suspicion was about 3 years prior to this event.
Mm-hmm.
It was Frank's birthday. He was on the phone with his roommate from college. I was sitting right there. He turned around to me, and after they hung up the phone, and he said, Fran, you won't believe what Mike said. He said I was the best he ever had. Well, as soon as he said that, I, of course, you know, my red flag in my head went up and said, well, what do you mean, the best you ever had? Did you have a gay experience with him?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, oh, that's ridiculous. How could you ever say that? And I said, Frank, it's not uncommon for college-age guys to, you know, one-third of college-age guys have some type of wrestling or same-sex experience, and it doesn't make you gay. And he said, no, absolutely not. You're crazy. That's ridiculous. So what I did at the time is I actually went to a therapist. And the therapist said to me, you know, if there's no other signs, then you should just drop it, and you're exaggerating it. And it was really bad advice. It was really very bad advice that I got.
Right, which we find happening with most people who are, you know, who are therapists who don't understand this whole situation.
Exactly. So I dropped it, and then 3 years later, he started to fall in love with this guy at the store. And then this started his three-year process of coming out, and through that process, he started drinking heavily. I never saw him drunk through a whole marriage. So he started drinking heavily. He started to become abusive, very controlling, extravagant spending, and our lives literally spiraled out of control.
When you just brought up the point about the drinking, we were having a discussion in our support chat group tonight about husbands, ex-husbands, and how so many of them are involved with drinking. And do you find that from the, you know, people that you're working with, that a lot of them have husbands who are drinking?
The ones that are struggling with coming are definitely drinking. The ones that have made peace with it and they're very comfortable with their sexuality are not drinking.
No, I meant the gay husbands, the ones who get married.
Yeah, no, the gay husbands, the ones that are coming out. Yeah, I do believe there's a lot of alcoholism and drug use as well.
Right, because we were talking about how helpful it was for some of our women to go to Al-Anon.
Yes, very.
And was that one of the steps you took?
I didn't go to Al-Anon, and I really wish I had. The only reason I didn't is because I was in my doctoral program training to be a therapist at that time, and I was embarrassed to go to Al-Anon. And when I look back, I think how ridiculous that was. It would have helped me so much. But I didn't want anybody else to see that I was having all these problems.
Right.
You know?
And I think that's one of the things that we try to do is we try to, you know, hide.
Sure.
And hide these problems because we feel embarrassed, we feel ashamed.
Right. My husband was a very successful businessman in the community. You know, he was very involved with the church. I didn't want anybody to see me there. I wanted to keep it very private.
Now, when he was going through this relationship with this man, what was his explanation to you?
Oh,
I'm sure he kept denying it, right?
He said that he needed a brother figure, that his brother was, he had one brother, and they were never close. They were 6 years apart. Interesting enough, Frank was, like, close to 40, and this guy was, like, 27. He said he needed a brother. He needed a friend. He wanted somebody that he could connect with on a more personal level, and that there was absolutely nothing sexual about it. They were just friends.
Now, did you believe that at the time?
No, not at all. Once I saw that guy and I saw the glazed look in Frank's eyes and I saw him starting to go to the gym, a man who had never gone to the gym, and I saw him start to, it was almost the same characteristics that a man gets when he's having an affair with a woman. He just started to transform right before my eyes. Nothing mattered as much as that guy. You know, it would be like, I would say, Frank, the kids and I are, you know, have an important meeting at school tonight, or we have a family function, and he didn't care. And he was the type of family guy that was with us every night. And then all of a sudden, he just needed to be with that guy. No matter what we said, he wanted to be with that guy.
So how far into the relationship did you finally get any kind of confession from him?
His story changed about 10 times. 10 times is minor. You know what, Bonnie? My phone is beeping, and I'm going to pick up the landline.
Go ahead.
You there?
I'm here.
Okay, good. I think the battery was dying. His story changed so many times. He said, Fran, I'm straight. There's no way I'm anything but straight. Then he said, I'm gay. I think I am gay. I must be gay. Then he said he was bisexual. Then he stayed on the bisexual route for a while. Then he went back to being gay. Then he said he was straight.
And eventually, the reason that I ultimately left is because he became so abusive, he literally tried to kill me. I had the police at the house.
Mm-hmm.
So even up till the day that I left, he was denying that he was gay. Within a year of me leaving him, and I left him because he did not want to be separated,
mm-hmm.
within a year, he fell in love with another man and went to Vermont to form a civil union, to be married in a civil union with him. And then I said, now you're going to tell me you're not gay? And he said, well, yeah, I'm gay. So he just could not, he could not admit it to himself, to anybody. And we divorced in 2000, between 2000 and 2005. He really struggled with the relationship he was in. He said he was not happy, and his alcohol abuse turned to drug abuse. And then,
oh, this is when he was living in Vermont?
No, he was living here. He only went to Vermont because at the time it was one of the few places that had
civil
union.
So then they moved back to this area?
Right.
And did you meet the man?
I met the man once. He was very, he was not a nice man. He did not want Frank to be involved with our children. He didn't. He was very manipulative and controlling of Frank, and they fought a lot. Apparently, they had a lot of domestic violence situations where the police were called to their house.
Wow!
And then in 2005, Frank decided he was going to leave him, and he pulled away from him, and they started dividing up their bank accounts. And one night, I got a phone call that Frank had hung himself in the basement of their home.
Mm-mm-mm.
Yeah, that was in 2005.
Now, had you been seeing your children at that point?
Had he been seeing our children?
Uh-huh.
He had, and let me preface this by telling you that prior to all this, he was an absolutely wonderful father.
Right.
When he started coming out, he pulled away from the children a lot, and he was really not involved with the children. He was a little bit more involved with our younger daughter, who at the time was 16. Our older daughter was 18. He committed suicide 1 month before her high school graduation. And 2 months after our youngest daughter's 16th birthday.
How did they cope? Let's not even get to the suicide yet, but how were they coping with the whole gay issue?
You know, Bonnie, I have to tell you, I thought my kids were amazing through the process.
Mm-hmm.
They were more upset about the abuse and the alcoholism than the gay issue.
Mm-hmm.
They were very supportive of their dad being gay.
Mm-hmm.
And almost became like an activist for him. You know?
Yeah, we had that conversation tonight also in our support group, that it seems that girls are much more sympathetic to the fathers,
mm-hmm.
almost as if they're trying to protect them.
Yeah, I could see that.
You know, because women by nature are more nurturing, caring, loving.
Right.
And they feel that, you know, here, I think it's just inherent in their thinking that their fathers are going to be under attack by society. They have
yep.
to try to help them.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
but
that's really the role that the kids play. But his see, what happened is the alcoholism, and then later we found out the drug use, really started to change his personality.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what they couldn't deal with.
And
you know,
he said that he was very close with them before this, but all of a sudden he kind of distanced himself, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. He distanced himself because he didn't really know how to deal with them anymore because he was so tainted by the alcohol and the drugs.
Mm-hmm.
He really entered a different life. Like, he even looked different. I remember he came, my daughter was a ballerina at the time, and he came to one of her ballet performances, and I almost didn't recognize him between his demeanor and his clothes, and you know, he had gotten very thin and gaunt, and he looked terrible.
Now, at the time that, you know, you received the phone call about his death, he was still living with this man?
No, he actually moved out
a week
prior, and he signed a lease to move into a condo right up the street from where we lived.
Mm-hmm.
In the same neighborhood. So he wanted to be close to us again, and he was trying very hard to reestablish a relationship with the kids and myself. In fact, 2 days before he died, he was here at my home planning our daughter's graduation party together.
Mm-hmm. Did he leave any kind of note?
You know, Bonnie, he left a note for the boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And till this day, I truly believe there were notes for the children, and the boyfriend took those notes. Because
wow.
he was a writer. I mean, not by trade, but he wrote, like, beautiful cards and thank you notes. And I just find it very hard to believe that he would have wrote a note to the boyfriend but not to his children.
Well, it's possible because, you know, don't forget, for somebody to go to that extent to commit suicide, they're not thinking in a normal state of mind.
Well, that's true, and they also found cocaine in his blood, so
mm-hmm.
he wasn't thinking clearly. The note was scribbled and not very coherent.
Right. So how are your girls dealing with that?
Well, it's been 5 years, and they are they've been really amazing through it. I think the one saving grace has been that they knew their dad died with cocaine in his bloodstream.
Mm-hmm.
If he did not have the drug in his bloodstream, I think they would have
had a harder time.
Exactly. But they knew he was not thinking clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what I think helped them through it.
Right. I think that certainly that must have made a difference in, you know, the healing process for them.
Right. But, I mean, it's hard. My older daughter's getting married, and of course, you know, she would love her father to be there to walk her down the aisle. And it's very sad. We as hard as it was on all of us, we all miss him very much.
Well, sure. That won't change.
Right.
You know, and especially you had so many good years together before all this happened.
Yeah, yeah.
And those are kind of the years that you gravitate back to.
Mm-hmm.
The foundation of what was your marriage.
Right.
So the title of the book, A Pebble in His Shoe, can you talk a little bit about how you came up with that title?
Well, that is a statement that Frank made throughout this process. He kept saying, Fran, I feel like I have a pebble in my shoe. And I didn't really understand what he meant until it really started to unfold. There was just something uncomfortable that he couldn't quite figure out. I think he always knew that he was gay. He couldn't quite figure out what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't quite figure out how to go from A to B once he was married with children.
How about his family? Did he have parents who were pretty staunch Catholic? Or
his parents, they were not staunch Catholic, and they 100% supported him.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, 100%. His family supported him so much that they pretty much stopped talking. Well, they did. They didn't even talk to their grandchildren,
wow.
my children, after we divorced. They supported him so much.
Now, that's unusual, right?
I thought it was very unusual.
Were they close before that?
They were, you know, pretty much. Not unusually close, but...
Now, did they blame you for breaking up the marriage?
They thought that it was that I should have stayed with him.
Because we
yeah.
brought up that issue in our support group tonight also, that, you know, these men, a lot of them look at it like they were fine in the marriage. We were the ones who broke up the marriage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they weren't the ones who wanted to leave. We're the ones who were throwing out the marriage.
Right.
And I think a lot of times the families think like that also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Frank used to say that to me all the time. You know, we took vows for better or worse. You know, how could you give this up? This is our marriage. And, you know, we married before God and all that. And I said, well, that's great, but you are in love with another man and you are an alcoholic now and now you're abusive. So I think all those rules don't apply anymore, you know?
Right. I always tell women when they come up with that, I always say, you know, you take vows for rich or poor, you know, in sickness and health, not for straight or for gay. That's
exactly.
Not part of a marriage vow.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
they don't
there's
have
no,
to
no
feel guilty
like that.
Because they're walking out of a marriage where there's homosexuality.
Right.
So how about the healing process for you? Let's talk a little bit about that, because one of the things that I know that you're a very big advocate of is forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Okay. At the time that I was going through my divorce, I was doing, I was in my doctoral program at Chestnut Hill, and I was doing my dissertation, and I did it on forgiveness in the prison system. And I studied forgiveness and empathy And it was really a great segue for me into helping me begin to forgive Frank. Because basically the premise was is that he did not choose to be gay. He did love me when we got married. And if I don't let this go, and if I don't move forward in my life, then I'm never going to heal. And I'm going to be bitter and angry and resentful. Because I can tell you, Bonnie, I spent those years of his coming out being bitter and angry and resentful. And I was so angry during those years that I actually developed vocal nodules in my throat. So I just came to a decision that I either let this go or I'm never going to move forward. So I chose to forgive him. And that was my way of healing and moving forward. And in that process, I was journaling, which helped me to write the book, which was a very cathartic experience for me. But, I think that forgiveness is a process. I think you could forgive your husband 1 week and the next week not forgive him at all. I think you can forgive and not forget. I think you can forgive him and not ever tell your husband that you forgive him. It could be just something that you do internally so that you don't have a weight on your shoulders. You know, I think there's many different types of forgiveness, but the important part of it is that you can move forward and be free.
How about self-forgiveness? Did you have any issues having to deal with that? Forgiving
absolutely. Self-forgiveness is one of the hardest types of forgiveness. I will be the first one to tell you that I struggled with that a lot because I called my husband every name in the book, which I won't say online, on air. But I said very terrible things to him and I didn't even flinch when I said them because I was angry. I was hurt. I was sad. I was disappointed. So in retrospect, I am so grateful now that I was able to forgive myself and to forgive him before he committed suicide. Because if I didn't, I don't know how I would be feeling right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I was able to apologize to him for the horrible names that I called him, and he was able to apologize to me for all the hurt and pain that he caused me and the children, and we were able to come to that place of forgiveness.
And I think it's wonderful when people can do that. You know, I'm all for forgiving when it's earned or deserved. But like you say, if you can forgive, even if it's not deserved, you're only helping yourself.
Right.
You know,
I mean,
you're two steps ahead of me on that, Francine. I still haven't been able to pull that.
I know, Bonnie. I know you have a hard time with that. But I'll tell you, I try to look at it as a gift you give yourself.
Right. Yeah, that's a very good way to. How about Misty, what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm going to lean more a little towards what Dr. Barbetta has said here in terms of I always use forgiveness with the women that I work with, you know, because I'm a life coach, therapy by trade, but do life coaching with the straight wives. And I've come to learn, I start with forgiveness and forgiving themselves. Because, you know, when you forgive yourself, I think that's the most important place to start. Because a lot of these women I get as clients, they're nowhere near or they're nowhere ready to forgive the gay husband. And I can't force it, nor can they force it. But it's a process, and I think it just evolves beautiful when they start forgiving themselves. And there's all sorts of things of where we start working, you know, with forgiving themselves. Like a lot of things that pops up a lot with the women I work with is the red flags that come up. They blame themselves for not addressing them.
Was that something you went through, Francine? I'm not in the beginning, but later on.
But in retrospect, like she said, you know, like we went on our honeymoon. One of the places we went on our honeymoon was San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And in the one of the ballrooms was a gay convention of like 500 men in tuxedos.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget opening the door to that ballroom and seeing all those men and Frank quickly shutting the door. And, you know, I didn't think anything of it until 15 years later. You know, like, did he plan the trip? Did he know there was going to be a gay convention there? You know, I don't know. But there are so many things in retrospect that I didn't pick up because I was in love, and I thought, well, he's married to me. How, why would a gay man get married? At that time, you didn't even think of that.
Even at this time, people don't think about it. Even with everything that people know today, people still don't understand the whole concept of why a gay man would get married.
Mm-hmm.
And even though certainly homosexuality has come a long way in this country in the last 20, 30, or 40 years, it's nowhere where it's going to need to be to where people are going to stop hoping that they're not gay. You know, as long as people are always picked on, discriminated against, made to feel separate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of it is religious belief,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of it is, you know, brought into the from family generations. That I can certainly see where, you know, gay is not treated equally, so people don't want to be gay.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also a lot of gay people are really socialized in a straight society to want the same thing that straight people want. They want their family, they want the wife, they want the house, they want the children.
Mm-hmm.
This is our so-called all-American dream.
Right.
For most people, becomes a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the bottom line is that that's in their heads, you know, what they're thinking about as being what everybody should be having, so why shouldn't they have it? So, I don't know, even if homosexuality was truly much more accepted in this world, I don't know if people would really be more honest about it. You know, I just think we're socialized to be married.
Mm-hmm.
And if men think they can be married or they can be heterosexual, that's always going to be the preference.
Mm-hmm.
What about moving on in your own life? Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. I am in a wonderful place right now. I have my private practice where I counsel a lot of women who are straight spouses. I also help them work on alternatives to their marriage when they want to. I have the book, and I am now in a wonderful relationship with a man who is everything I could have ever dreamed of, and we are planning on getting engaged very soon, and I never even in a million years would have thought that I could have found love in this way at 50 years old.
Okay,
so
can you tell us a little bit about that? Because let's say after the whole thing was over with your husband,
mm-hmm.
you know, I always tell women not to jump.
Mm-hmm.
First, rebuild your own life, because when you're coming out of these marriages, there are so many different, you know, issues that you have to put together again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that maybe you found in your practice, I certainly found it in mine, that women go in one of two directions. They either totally withdraw, or they have to totally jump in and meet somebody immediately to prove
mm-hmm.
that it wasn't them that was at fault of the marriage.
Right.
And when those women jump, they're jumping right back into the same kind of destructive relationship. Because there are a lot of predators who are straight. You know, you can't just go say because somebody's not gay, it's going to be a healthy marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So I always tell women that it's important to take the time to figure out, you know, how these things happened, what's within you that allowed it to happen, or, you know, why you didn't see the flags, or how do you avoid it the next time, and to give yourself at least a year or two to build yourself up before you jump out there again.
Right.
So is that something that you did also?
Definitely. I was divorced in 2000 and recently fell in love again, so it was 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout that that 10-year period, my focus was on raising my children.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, with the suicide thrown in the middle of that, it really put us all back a couple steps. So we had to, like, step back, punt, and regroup, and, you know, I just needed they had to be my priority, you know. Divorcing, they went to a Catholic school when I divorced, and then having the dad go through that. So throughout that time period, I actually had a friend who was my lover, and it was a very, it was more of a casual relationship, but
uh-huh.
I knew I could count on him when I needed him, and it worked for me,
uh-huh.
you know. It didn't interfere with parenting. It was more quiet. It was not a big deal, but it was just what I needed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I always tell women that the first man that you're with after any kind of breakup is your transition man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the man that's going to get you through and help you see that there's a new world out there, a new life to be had. So I was with my lover for quite a few years, and then last year it just came to a place where I needed to put that behind me and move forward. mm-hmm. children were older now. They're both in their 20s. It's time for me to move on. I sort of had this mindset when I turned 50, it was going to be my time. So that's exactly what happened. I turned 50 in December. I met Chris, who is definitely the love of my life, and I couldn't be happier.
How did you meet him?
I met him on eHarmony.
Aww.
Yep, and I would never in a million years thought that I would do that, but I did it, and we were a perfect match.
Isn't that wonderful?
And I have to tell women out there, you need to experience straight sex, because once you do, your life will be different.
I tell that to women all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel so badly for women who have had a lifetime of only a gay husband for 20
mm-hmm.
or 30 years and forget gay sex, no sex.
Mm-hmm.
But even when they were having sex maybe early in the marriage, it was with a gay man, that they've been really sexually stunted, I guess,
mm-hmm.
for lack of a better word, muted maybe.
They settle for so little. I mean, it's very sad.
They do.
And the feeling of rejection is so overwhelming when you're the aggressor and you keep getting rejected by your husband.
Now, did you go through that with your husband?
Yes. I was always the sexual aggressor. And
right.
He had every excuse in the book. He was too tired. He had a stomach ache.
And I try to tell women, this is not how a straight man acts.
No.
A straight man wants sex.
Right. Absolutely.
You know, they're not looking to have headaches and toothaches and backaches and
right.
front aches and
right.
fingernails that are growing in the wrong direction.
You
with
got
a gay
it.
Husband, you have every possible excuse in the world.
Yep.
With a straight man, they want to touch you, they want to feel you, they want to
yep.
go with you.
Yep.
And, you know, that's what builds intimacy in a relationship, where you never have that kind of intimacy with a gay man.
No. And it's a absolutely wonderful feeling, and every woman deserves to enjoy sex and to be treated like a queen and to be loved the right way.
And I'm really glad you brought up about eHarmony, because I think a lot of times women think, how am I going to meet a man? You know,
mm-hmm.
it's so hard today. And I tell them, take a chance on the internet dating, because I know a lot of happy stories with a lot of happy endings.
It is the way
you
of
really
our
want
generation.
To meet someone,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's a good way to go, right?
Yeah, because I'm not a bar person,
mm-hmm.
and I'm working all the time, and I'm in a private practice by myself, so I don't have colleagues. I'm not in a situation to meet other people at work,
mm-hmm.
and by the time I come home, I'm exhausted. So, I gave this a try, and it worked. And sometimes, you know, it takes a while, but.
Did you meet any guys that you weren't interested in?
Yes, totally. Like, no chemistry.
You can't get discouraged, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You can't let that stop you. You know, eventually you'll find someone.
Right. I met boring men. I met men that just didn't feel comfortable to me. There was no chemistry, and it's very. I mean, I was very independent. I was 10 years on my own. I didn't need to find a man. I had my lover. I wanted to find a man. I wanted to find somebody that I could really be in love with and that I was compatible, you know, on a personality level, compatible with. That's very important. I think a lot of women are financially needy, so they just settle for somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And
or emotionally needy, and
yes.
they just settle for somebody.
Right. So
you know,
I think
they just
it's
want
very...
somebody to love them without,
yeah.
you know, caring about all the other factors that make somebody, you know, love you for real.
Mm-hmm. It's very important to learn to take care of yourself first. And then everything else will fall into place.
That's what, you know, we always say. We have one of our wonderful support group members, Gail, and she always says, be kind to yourself.
Yep.
And it's so true that if you can't take care of yourself, you'll never be able to truly love someone again,
mm-hmm.
I think. Do you feel that way?
I absolutely feel that way. I know that if, this relationship is very secure and it's very comfortable and it definitely has a future, but if, God forbid, something happened and it ended, I would be fine because I've learned to depend on myself.
And I think that's the best message that any woman could hear,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, to love a man should enhance your life. Your
mm-hmm.
life shouldn't have to depend on it.
Mm-hmm.
That you have to love yourself enough. And I think, you know, I very much like you spent 11 years in the wilderness raising my children. You
mm-hmm.
know, love was not part of my game plan at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But when my heart was ready, then it opened up, and I began the whole adventure of finding the right man.
Mm-hmm.
And And I always say, you know, I went through hundreds to find the one right man.
Mm-hmm.
And if you stop after three or four or five and say, there's nobody out there for me, then you're not going to find anyone.
Mm-hmm.
You have to keep looking. There will be somebody out there who's right for you.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't get discouraged because, you know, the first few didn't work. And it's funny, I have a friend who also belongs to eHarmony.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true, you know, what's, some of the men that are part of eHarmony would be the last, you know, man in the world that I'd ever want to go out with.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I keep telling her, don't get discouraged. You know, you can't just have a few men, you have to go through hundreds.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, you know, the right one will be out there. It's just
mm-hmm.
a matter of having the perseverance and taking the time that it needs and having your goal set that, you know, I'm looking to meet the right man.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm so excited for you.
Yeah, Bonnie, you know, there's something else I want to say. One of the things when I was going through my struggle with Frank is that, you know, I have always struggled with my weight. It has
mm-hmm.
gone up and down. And, you know, my father, who I adore, said to me one day, you know, Francie, maybe if you lose weight, he will be interested in you.
Mm-hmm.
And even through the marriage, Frank always made me feel really bad when I had gained weight. And in the last 10 years, especially after the suicide, I had put on more weight.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know what, I am, this is me, this is who I am. And hopefully I'm going to meet a man that loves me the way I am. And I did. And that is very, I think it's an important message for women to hear, that men don't only love skinny women.
Well, that's, you know, funny, because that's the message I always get out there since I am a fat woman. And, you know, I always felt the same way. You know, certainly other times of my life I've been a lot thinner.
Mm-hmm.
After going through eating disorders, bulimia,
mm-hmm.
and everything else in my life.
Mm-hmm.
But even when I met my ex-husband, you know, I was at my thinnest point ever. It didn't, you know, and I looked really great. It
mm-hmm.
didn't help me in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've had to first come to terms to accept who I am. But, you know, if I can't find a man who can love me for what I am, my boyfriend always just looks at me and says, okay, there's more of you to love.
Yeah.
So that's how he
views
me.
Smart man.
And
good.
I think that is, you know, if you can't find a man with that philosophy, then you don't have the right man.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm so happy that, you know, you brought that up, because so many of our women who have self-esteem issue have sexual esteem issues because of their weight. And, you know, what really upsets me is when I find women who weigh 120 pounds who have self-esteem issues with their weight.
Mm-hmm.
Because
right.
their husbands are telling them that they're too heavy.
Yeah, right.
Or they're not
terrible.
Pretty enough or beautiful
mm-hmm.
enough.
Right.
And I think to myself, you think you have a weight problem at 120 pounds?
Mm-hmm.
But it's amazing what these men can do to your heads.
Yep.
You know, and they make you start believing that it is you instead of
mm-hmm.
them. So I think that definitely that's a really good point to bring up. And let me ask you this. When you were married in the beginning with Frank, I mean, how was your sex life in the early years?
It was about once a week, and I was always the aggressor, and there were a lot of things that he wouldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was, I wouldn't say it was bad, but I didn't know better because
You had limited experience, right?
Limited experience, yes. So it wasn't until I was out of the marriage that I realized that it wasn't half as good as it could have been.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And that's why a lot of women tell me, although I hate to keep pounding home, that they had a good sex life with their gay husbands until they meet a straight man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'll always say to me, no, my sex life was good. And then they call me back and they say, you know what? You were right. My sex life was horrible.
Mm-hmm.
Now I understand what a sex life is supposed to be about.
Right.
And I think you have no clue when you're with a gay man, no matter how hard they try, you know, they don't want to be there.
Right.
It's not what they want to do. So they're going to try just to do the minimum
mm-hmm.
to get by so that, you know, you're not going to sit and question them.
Mm-hmm. I think the best sex that I ever had with Frank was during the period that he was falling in love with the other guy.
Out of
and
guilt, right?
Sounds really strange, but I think that he was really turned on in his mind, in his fantasy mind, about the other guy, and he took that out on me.
Well, that, or else maybe he was feeling really guilty.
Mm.
Or he was feeling you were catching on. And
right. He was overcompensating.
Usually that's what happens.
Yeah.
When they think that you're catching on to something.
Yeah.
that's when they'll do their best to make sure that they're,
yeah,
you know, doing their best in bed to
right.
lay any of your fears or suspicions.
Right.
So, Nancy, are there any parting words you would like to say? I mean, I've kept you here for really much longer than I know that you really wanted to stay.
That's okay.
It was interesting.
It was enjoyable. My parting words is that please, you know, any woman that hears this, be strong and move on with your life if that's the choice that you're making, and try to find a loving, wonderful man to hold you tight and to take care of you sexually, and that you'll take care of him sexually, and you could have passion back in your life. But it is not everything. You know, what's more important is that you trust in yourself and that you stand tall and you have nothing to be embarrassed about. You didn't do anything wrong. You know, loving someone does not make you wrong. So, and that's what women are guilty of, loving someone, and how can you be wrong with that?
And could you just bring up one last point before you go?
Mm-hmm.
For women who, you know, we have this constant, you know, problem coming up of women who say, I don't have any proof. You know, I can't be for sure. You know, if I walk out, then, you know, and I don't know, then I could be accusing him of something.
Mm-hmm.
I always say, you don't have to have any proof. You just have to be unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, half the world who, you know, that's not gay, you know, they get divorced. It doesn't
mm-hmm.
have to be a gay thing to be unhappy in a marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that with the women you're working with?
Yeah, some of them I do. Ones that really need to know, I tell them to hire a private investigator. Soon enough they'll find out. But, yeah, I mean, if there's alcohol abuse or physical or mental abuse, they shouldn't be there. I try to help women see the whole picture.
Or if you see, you know, some of the signs that you would say, if you see a sharp change in behavior of someone, like you were mentioning about your husband running to the gym.
Right.
I always tell women running to the gym is one sure sign that something's happening in your marriage.
Absolutely.
Or something's happening outside your marriage, shall
yeah,
I say.
Definitely.
And was he going to the straight gym?
Was he going to a straight
gym?
Yeah,
he wasn't going to a gay gym, right?
No, he wasn't going to a gay gym, but there's a lot of gay men at, you know.
No, they said there's a lot more gay sex going on at the straight gym than at
I'm sure. I'm sure.
Yeah, that's the biggest pickup places in the
yeah.
straight gym. But also, any major changes in behavior? Did he ever talk about that mentally or emotionally he's just not feeling like himself? Or
all the time. That was the pebble in his shoe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When a guy just can't define what's wrong in his life,
yep,
I think that
yep.
has to be your first hint that that's
yep.
probably what's wrong in his life.
Yeah.
So we're really hoping that people will look up your book, A Pebble in His Shoe. You can get it. What's the best way to get it on Amazon?
Well, you can get it on exlibris.com. You can get it on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, or Borders.com.
And also you have your own website, correct?
I have my own website, www.drbarbetta, no periods, drbarbetta.com. I offer a free straight spouse support group the second Tuesday of every month in my Levittown, Pennsylvania office, and I specialize in doing straight spouse counseling.
Which is wonderful. And if you didn't have a pencil to write the information down, just drop me a note. And I'll certainly forward the information to you.
Thank you,
Francine.
Bonnie.
Thank you so much for being our guest. And I hope, if you don't mind, you'll come back later on.
Absolutely. I love it.
Time,
you're the best.
Say. So are you.
You're the best. Thank you.
All right, sweetie. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hi, Misty.
Hey, Bonnie. Wow.
Wasn't she wonderful?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it just goes to show how far and wide this reaches.
She's just an incredible woman, you know, who's been through so much. And, you know, when she told me a few months ago that she met somebody, I was just so happy for her.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, to me, any time that you can move on and meet your soulmate in life, to me, is a wonderful thing.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, and to bring up a little bit of a topic, I think it's so interesting that so many gay husbands use that against the wives and the women
in terms of many times I could tell you, I couldn't even count the times that my gay ex-husband would say, you know, you're my soulmate. You can't divorce me. We're meant to be together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think many of our women experience that, where that they use that against them and, of course, try to force them to stay. But, you know, being what I call dancing inside the circle of crazy, he led me to believe that, well, I can't divorce him. I guess we are meant to be together. Well, it was never a marriage to start with. Like you call it, it was a mismatch. But once you get out of that, get out of that circle of insanity and rebuild yourself and put yourself back out there, relationships are just so refreshing and so new. And it's
well,
not that all of them are
true.
Perfect.
And I think that another common thing that these guys say is that, I know that my ex-husband used to say this to me, is that you'll never meet anyone who will love you like I do.
Yeah.
And in the beginning, you buy into that because, you know, every woman wants to be loved. And, of course, when we fell in love with these men, we wanted them to love us. And even if it's not the way that we thought we were going to be loved, you know, because we're so beaten down, we really believe that at least they're loving us somehow. And when they tell us that we're never going to meet anybody who can love us like they do, you know, once again, all that feeling of...
Well, actually, I don't want to meet someone to love me like he did. You know,
that's for sure.
For real, you know. So it's just, there's so many mind games in these types of relationships. There's so many layers of complication that I think many therapists, social workers, counselors do not understand. And thank goodness that, you know, she does serve that area and sees people in person. You know, wouldn't that have been great if we would have had someone like that in our community when we were going through this process? So it's just so wonderful.
Yeah, it's really important for women, as we always say, that you have to find someone who you're really comfortable with, someone who really knows you, you know, and what your issues are. And if you find people who can't understand this particular issue, it's time to move on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All therapists and counselors are not going to be a fit for each person that goes to see them. And if it's not a fit, I always tell, you know, I tell people, you know, when you're searching for a therapist, when you're searching for a life coach, when you're searching for a counselor, what, you know, of some sort, it has to be a fit. You're the consumer. You're paying for that service.
Mm-hmm.
If it doesn't work, that person is a professional. They need to understand it's not working. And it's okay.
I have this really great article here. I just would like to spend a little time talking about it. And
okay.
It's called 8 Ways to Spot Emotional Manipulation. Because
mm-hmm.
I think this is a common feature that so many of us go through.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to give you like the abbreviated list. But the first way is that there's no use in trying to be honest with an emotional manipulator. You make a statement and it will be turned around. For example, I am really angry that you forgot my birthday. The response is, it makes me feel sad that you would think that I would forget your birthday. I should have told you of the great personal stress I am facing at the moment, but you see, I didn't want to trouble you. You are right. I should have put all this pain, don't be surprised to see real tears at this point, aside and focused on your birthday. Sorry. Even as you're hearing these words, you get creeped out sensation that they really don't mean that they're sorry at all, but since they've said the words, you're pretty much left with nothing more to say. Either you find yourself suddenly you're babysitting their angst. Under all circumstances, if you feel this angle is being played, don't capitulate. Do not care. Do not accept an apology that feels like crap. If it feels like crap, it probably is. Remember, rule number one, if dealing with an emotional blackmailer, trust your gut. Trust your senses, and once an emotional manipulator finds a successful maneuver, it's added to his hit list, and you'll be fed a steady diet of this crap. Do you agree with that?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, I almost started laughing when you were reading it. That was like my conversation. I reflected back on conversations I would be having with my now ex-husband. I mean, he would certainly fell into it. I'm sure we had that conversation of that example you just read probably every day of our marriage. My marriage definitely fell into that category. And I think most of the women I've worked with, and I'm sure most of the women you've worked with, their relationship falls into that category as well.
Here's one that says, an emotional manipulator is a picture of a willing helper. If you ask them to do something, they will almost always agree. That is, if they didn't volunteer to do it first. Then when you say, okay, thanks, they make a bunch of heavy sighs or other nonverbal signs that let you know they don't really want to do whatever said thing happens to be. When you tell them it doesn't seem like they want to do whatever, they'll turn around and try to make it seem like, of course they wanted to, and how unreasonable you are. This is a form of crazy making, which is something emotional manipulators are very good at. Rule number two, if an emotional manipulator says yes, make them accountable for it. Do not buy into the sighs and subtleties. If they don't want to do it, make them tell it to you up front, or just put on the Walkman headphones and run a bath and leave them to in their home theater. What do you think of that?
I think it's humorous, but it's sad because it's true with many of the relationships that I hear our women talk about. And with my own relationship that I experienced with a gay husband, there was so many forms of manipulation.
Mine would always say, okay, I'll do it, and then go, yeah, you know, like when by the time they're done, you say, oh, never mind, that's okay.
Yeah, and I can do it. I would just
think out of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Number three is crazy making, saying one thing and later assuring you they did not say it. If you find yourself in a relationship where you figure you should start keeping a log of what's been said because you're beginning to question your own sanity, you're experiencing emotional manipulation. An emotional manipulator is an expert in turning things around, rationalizing, justifying, and explaining things away. They can lie so smoothly that you can sit looking at black, and they'll call it white, and argue so persuasively that you'll begin to doubt your own senses. Over a period of time, this is so insidious and eroding, it can literally upset your sense of reality. Warning, emotional manipulation is very dangerous. It is very disconcerting for an emotional manipulator if you begin carrying a pad of paper and pen, making notations during conversations. Feel free to let them know that you're just feeling so forgetful these days that you want to record their words for posterity's sake. The damnedest thing about this is having too much to do, is having to do such a thing is a clear example of why you should be seriously thinking about removing yourself from the range in the first place. If you're toting a notebook to safeguard yourself, that old crap meter should be flashing steady by now.
Oh, my goodness. Is this comedy hour? Because I think you're reading the biography of my marriage right now. Oh, dear.
I think a lot of ours. Guilt? Emotional manipulators are excellent guilt mongers. They can make you feel guilty for speaking up or not speaking up, for being emotional or not being emotional enough, for giving and caring or for not giving and caring enough. Anything is fair game and open to guilt with an emotional manipulator. Emotional manipulators seldom express their needs or desires openly. They get what they want through emotional manipulation. Guilt is not the only form, but it is a potent one. Most of us are pretty conditioned to do whatever is necessary to reduce our feelings of guilt. Another powerful emotion used is that of sympathy. An emotional manipulator is a great victim. They inspire a profound sense of needing to support, care for, and nurture. Emotional manipulators seldom fight their own fights or do their own dirty work. The crazy thing is that when you do it for them, which they will never ask for directly, they may just turn around and say they certainly didn't want you to or expect anything from you. Try to make a point of not fighting for other people's battles or doing their dirty work for them. A great line is, I have every confidence in your ability to work this out on your own. Check out the response and note the crap meter once again. So I think that's true.
Yeah.
And there's some really other good ones there. Emotional manipulators fight dirty. They don't deal with things directly. If you have a headache, an emotional manipulator will have a brain tumor. This is so true, isn't it? No matter what your situation is, the emotional manipulator has probably been there or is there now, but only 10 times worse. It's hard after a period of time to feel emotionally connected to an emotional manipulator because they have a way of derailing conversations and putting the spotlight back on themselves. If you call them on this behavior, they will become deeply wounded or very petulant and call you selfish or claim that you are the one who's always in the spotlight. The thing is that even though you know this is not the case, you are left with the impossible task of proving it. Don't bother. Trust your gut and walk away. Now, that one is so true, isn't it?
That one, wow, it rings very true to me. Exactly. It's just unbelievable. And it's unbelievable because here's how I'm going to answer that. You know, I'm sort of giggling now because I'm looking back to think how much I danced inside the circle of crazy. Because if you would have read this list to me when I was married to my gay ex-husband, I wouldn't believe any. I wouldn't be recognizing any of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think we tend to not recognize how bad it is. And now I can look at it and say, wow, I was crazy for putting up with this, that, or whatever. But, you know, 12, 13 years ago, I wouldn't even recognize that in the marriage I had, I don't think.
This one's good. It says, emotional manipulators somehow have the ability to impact the emotional climate of those around them. When an
mm-hmm.
emotional manipulator is sad or angry, the very room thrums with it. It brings deep and instinctual response to find some way to equalize the emotional climate, and the quickest route is by making the emotional manipulator feel better, fixing whatever is broken for them. Stick with this type of loser for too long, and you'll be so meshed and codependent, you'll forget you even have needs, let alone that you have just as much right to have your needs met. And that's so true, isn't it?
That is so true, because, you know, you feel guilty for having any needs whatsoever because you shouldn't have any needs. I mean, whether your needs be to have a glass of water, you know, oh, well, you don't need that. You know, it's just really, wow, that rings so true.
And this last one says, emotional manipulators have no sense of accountability. They take responsibility for themselves or their behavior. It's always about what everyone else has done to them.
Mm-hmm.
One of the easiest ways to spot an emotional manipulator is that they often attempt to establish intimacy through the early sharing of deeply personal information that is generally of the hook you in and make you feel sorry for me variety. Initially,
oh,
they perceive this type of person as very sensitive, emotionally open, and maybe a little vulnerable. Believe me when I say that an emotional manipulator is about as vulnerable as a rabbit pit bull. And there will always be a problem or a crisis to overcome.
Wow.
I think these are all right on target, right?
I told you. I think you are reading the biography of my marriage.
I know.
You know,
there isn't everybody else.
Wow. Yeah, that was. And the one about the, you know, the mood and the energy of the person affecting everyone around. What comes to my mind is when I was married to my gay husband. My family, my friends would come visit. As soon as they would come, he would suddenly get sick, or you could just look at him and tell he was angry. The whole mood in the house would change, and he would run off to the bedroom and, like, quarantine himself in the bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
It was so embarrassing for me to make excuses for him. But, however, when his family would come to visit or a friend he had, I don't know what would happen if I exhibited the same behavior. So it's just really sad what we put ourselves through and some of the stuff we put up with when we are dancing inside the circle of crazy because we don't understand the degree of the craziness that it is.
I know. And we get so caught up in it that, you know, we lose perspective of everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I once again wonder if this happens to all women or just certain women. You know, if, you know, we always talk about the prototype of a woman that a gay man looks for. And it's just not, you know, a gay man, but any kind of predator looks for. And I think that so many of us, you know, fit that prototype. But I'm sure there are women who would never fall for this or who would never play into this. I don't know.
Right. And, you know, I think you made a very valid point that might need to be stressed once more before we end the show tonight, how that, excuse me, it's so important, you know, once you get right out of the relationship. I like the term that Dr. Barbetta used. She used it as the transition relationship, you know, the one, and it may not be the one you're going to be with for the rest of your life. But be careful jumping into those relationships so quickly because you know what, you may get the same type of relationship. And even if he is straight, like you said, he could be emotionally manipulative. He, you know, there's going to be threads of similarity in that relationship. So it really does take time to rebuild. I think that's so important. It does take time to rebuild. And you're worth rebuilding yourself and learning how to love yourself and learning, relearning who you are. I think it's so important.
And then again, we have to first figure out who we are because we've lost who we are.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Absolutely. As I had no idea who I was. I knew my name and my Social Security number. But other than that, I literally could not even tell you what my favorite color was.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't tell you what I liked to eat or didn't like to eat. I mean, just something that simple. I was so lost in this mass of confusion. I didn't know anything anymore. And I was spiritually and emotionally dead. I say I was just walking around robotic. You know,
that's how I was. I really felt like a fish rag. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, I just didn't like who I became. I didn't
mm-hmm.
have the strength to fight who I was.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess because every time I would try to stand up for myself, I got knocked down. And after
right.
a while, it's just like a survival instinct that you just acquiesce and you give in because you don't want to have conflict or fighting. You know, I'm not
exactly.
a fighting person by nature, and I don't want to hear somebody screaming at me for everything.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just easier to give in or say okay or not have a fight about it. And that's
mm-hmm.
when you start losing yourself, is when you start giving in for no reason at all. Just because you want to have peace in the house, and you know, it's so easy. And these guys, once they see that they can just, you know, raise their voices or yell a little bit, you know, and you're going to give in, that's how it just keeps intensifying. I know that with your ex-husband, he was very abusive, right?
Very. I mean, I think back on my relationship, and I mean, I'm very serious when I say this. I'm very lucky to be alive today. I'm very lucky to be alive today and tell about this. I know way more about domestic violence than I wish I knew because
mm-hmm.
I've experienced. And I never thought I would ever be the type of person that would experience that. When I went into the relationship, you know, I had a spark, had some fire in me. You know, I was very independent. My parents had taught me to be independent. You know, we had traveled a lot. I knew how to get around. I knew what to do. So, you know, it's just so scary over the years what abuse will erode inside of you and what you will put up with. And it's sad, just really sad.
Because I know that, you know, when I got married to my ex-husband, I was probably at my strongest point ever.
Mm-hmm.
Mentally, emotionally, physically, I looked the best ever. I was in a very strong position as far as my job, as far as
mm-hmm.
my life, as far as who I was. And it took me so many years to build up to that point. You know, I had just come off of a very destructive marriage to someone else before my gay husband. And, you know, like I say, it took me a long time to build myself up to the point where I was. But, boy, it didn't take me long to get myself beat back down.
Right.
You know, once again, they know how to push every button, how to manipulate you, how to make you feel inadequate.
Mm-hmm.
And all those feelings of self-doubt and, you know, insecurities that you have, they know where those panic, you know, to push those buttons to make you feel that sense of panic again.
Absolutely. And that's so sad because, you know, you can, what you build a lifetime creating and building up, it seems like it just can, you can allow it to just disappear before you know it's gone because they take away such small threads of it at a time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you realize how much is gone until, you know, you get outside that circle of crazy, as I call it. Once I stepped outside of that, I realized, oh, my goodness, what have I done? What have I put up with? Who am I? You know, so it's really, really a revelation once you step outside that circle and see what all you've put up with and realize some of the things that you normally wouldn't, that you wouldn't even bargain for or try to stay in. So it's interesting how that does that to us.
Absolutely. And next week we're going to be having on a very dear friend of mine, Carol Silverman. She's from the Straight Spouse Network, which
mm-hmm.
is another group that gives really good support to women, some women, who are looking for help. And along this journey, they have face-to-face meetings. They have online support all the time. You know, and Carol is really one of my idols in life. She is just wonderful. She's one of the founders of the group and mm-hmm. past president and board member. And
wow.
she really is an advocate of everything that we fight for. And with mm-hmm. the Straight Spouse Network, they have different divisions and different groups within the group. And I always say we don't have to always agree with everything all the time, but at least we have people out there who have a common bond, and I think that's a good starting point. So Carol will certainly be here to talk about what supports that they can give. And also in an upcoming show, you know, one of the ones that I really want to discuss, because it has been a topic, and we're going to get some research done on it and have other women calling in, we're going to talk about whether it's better to come from a house where you have an unhappy two-family household or better to come from a single-parent home. Because that really seems to always be a controversial subject, doesn't it, Misty?
Always. It always pops up, you know, in the chat room. It always pops up when, you know, we work with clients that are afraid to leave because they don't want to harm the children. And, you know, it's such a delicate topic, and it's something that certainly needs to be discussed because we have this topic come up so often in our line of work. So it's definitely
mm-hmm.
something that needs to be further discussed, you know, some good information given to these women because they really need it. They really need that.
Right. So, you know, just to sum things up, if I could be of any help to you, just write to me at bonk@aol.com. If you need to get in touch with Misty, she's at mistylynnhall@aol.com. You can go to my website at www.gayhusbands.com if you're looking for my newsletters or for other how to join our online support chat that happens twice a week on Thursday nights and Sunday nights. And Misty's going to be having a seminar coming up in May. What's the date for that, Misty?
That will be, excuse me, that will be on May the 8th. And if you want any information on that, all you have to do is email me or email you. And you know how to get me. So I would love to share more information with anyone that wants to know how to start rebuilding. And it's going to be from the ground up.
Okay. Can you give us a hint?
Absolutely. It's going to be of course, I always give out a put together a document that I email everyone, sort of like a little booklet. And it's such good information. And I create this information myself because, you know, as you know, we can't find a lot of gay, straight information out there that our straight wives need. So I put
mm-hmm.
together resources. I put together tips. I put together activities and things to get you on the path, to get you started. So that'll be a little bit about what we're going to do. We're going to generally discuss a lot of different things in terms of, you know, the discovery, the grief of what goes along with the discovery, you know, the transition phases of trying to find yourself. And then just some very helpful and practical tools to start rebuilding. And start rebuilding in terms of with yourself, learning who you are,
mm-hmm.
Finding things that you enjoy, giving you know, praising yourself, learning how to love yourself, those things. So we'll cover so many different topics. I think it'll be a very important one. And another thing I've been finding, you know, a lot of people ask me, well, you know, I've been divorced for 2 or 3 years. Is this for me? And what I'm finding more and more women contacting me that's been out of the marriage for quite some time, and they realize that they need to process some of this grief. They need to connect with other women that have gone through this.
Mm-hmm.
So I have in the workshops, I have everywhere from someone that's newly discovered to someone that may be out of the marriage and divorced for 2 to 3 years. And it always fits together nicely. So regardless of where you are in your process, if it's something that interests you on the topic of rebuilding, just shoot me an email and I'd be more than happy to share more information about that.
Okay, Misty. Well, thank you so much. And thanks to all our listeners. And please, you know, keep in touch with us and we'll be listening for you next week at the same time, same place. And I hope you all have a good week. And definitely, Misty, you have a wonderful week, too.
You, too. And you get better, Bonnie. Hope you
all right,
hope
thank
feel
you.
Much better this week. Okay.
All right,
see
love
you next
you.
Week. Bye-bye.
All right, bye.